Hey, Art Pod listener, welcome back to the podcast that brings you the thinkers and artists that matter in Michigan. Today, Art Pod is going to talk about change, all kinds of change, political, racial, technological. One of the things that all of these artists, be they storytellers, actors, directors, in one case, a movie house owner in a small town. Yeah, I'm going to count that as an artist. I think it's up there. How all of these people use change as the subject for their art helps us understand and think about it a little bit more clearly and probably in a different way than we would have otherwise. So there, that's my big theory about art and change. And we're going to get right down to it with our first artist. His name is LaRon Williams. He's a storyteller. Not to be confused with Juan Williams, I made that mistake. He sat down with Michigan Radio's Lester Graham on Stateside just this week.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Storytelling is as old as human understanding. Before there were news reporters or historians or poets or the written word, there were storytellers. There were the people who carried the knowledge of the people in their history. It's no wonder that a good storyteller still captures us and tells us about things that explain some of the larger issues and lessons of life in a way that we can understand. Listening to stories is in our genes. The University of Michigan is presenting a series called Understanding Race, and tomorrow night at the Michigan Theater, one of those storytellers will be doing what he does best. Joining us now, LaRon Williams. Welcome to Stateside. I think too often we think of storytellers as those nice little people who visit the local library and tell the stories to kids, and you do some of that, but tomorrow night you've got a story for adults.
Yeah, most people, the common perception is when they hear the term storyteller, they think of it as a children's activity. And so it requires some work. It's a little bit of an uphill struggle to get people to realize that it even can be something for adults. You know, people used to sit on the front porch and they would share adventures and talk about things that had happened. So kind of maybe even since the advent of television has storytelling kind of gotten relegated to the role of a child's thing.
But, right. Yeah, that's very true. The TV has really kind of skewed that. Although I think that you'd agree that there are some comedians out there, for example, who are great storytellers, and they just give it in snippets with a punchline. Not every story has a punchline.
Right.
So tell me something about your story, Elm Park 1955.
Yeah. It's a story about racial dynamics, really. It's based on true events from my life, all of which were, let's just say, at least somewhat they carried a lot of emotion. I'm trying to avoid using the word traumatic, radio listeners, but let's call them traumatic events. So my thoughts as a child were, of course, unformulated, but the impact of those events stayed with me and resonated. And as an adult, I was faced with a choice about what to do with that information. How can I take it and turn it into something constructive? So I created a story based on the trauma, but also I wanted it to be an explicatory piece. So it isn't simply about one person's bad break or some horrible things that happened to me in life. It's also an explicatory story about the dynamics of race in my community at particular points in time. It starts out in 1955, and that's why it has the title. And the area in Flint where I grew up is called Elm Park. So that's the title. But it also covers other time periods as well.
Talked about being traumatized. How did that express itself and how did it affect you?
Actually, I can give you a particular with that. One of the incidents in the story happened when I was 4 years old, 1955, when I was in a local barbershop, probably the most popular barbershop on the south side of Flint. And I happened to see the picture of Emmett Till that was in Jet magazine that year. And I don't know if you've ever had a chance to see that image, but imagine a four-year-old looking at something so grotesque and knowing that it was a human being. So and also knowing that this was an African-American boy like I was. And particularly in the context of that year, we learn about Emmett Till's death, his murder, but there were several lynchings that happened during 1955. And in fact, one just a week before Till was killed, where there was an African-American man who was shot in the back in public on, in fact, on the lawn of the courthouse with several witnesses, dozens of witnesses, and was never the murderers were never prosecuted for that crime.
Yeah, so there was an existence. Nobody saw.
Yeah, everybody saw, but nobody saw. Yeah. So there was an existing milieu that even at age four, I already knew about. I knew a lot about. So when I saw that picture, the trauma was that I became him.
Right.
I became this boy, this grotesque looking, I'll just say creature, that I saw in this magazine. So much of the story flows out of my recognition of my vulnerability being like Emmett Till. And then there are other things that build on that too.
Is this storytelling a way for you to deal with all the leftover feelings from that young boy in 1955?
I suppose some of that is in there, but my strongest feeling about that is no, it's not really, because I think of my storytelling as a profession, and even if I want to share those traumatic events, I have to get them to a point where I'm not using them as therapy in front of an audience, which it's a difficult balance sometimes. I have stories that I haven't told. I've conceptualized them for years, but I haven't told them because the emotional pain is still so strong. So I have to be over it enough that I'm not relying on an audience situation to take care of me in the middle of it. I'm not relying on an audience to take it anywhere. It's for me, this is a story. And as I said earlier, it's an explicatory story. The value of the story lies in that it offers social explanations for what happened, even for why Emmett Till was killed, even for the things that come later. It offers explanations for those things. So I'm not asking people to come there and simply open up their hearts. I'm asking people to come and listen to a factual account that just happens to be personal as well.
Now, storytellers have a knack for telling engaging stories. We, you know, understand the characters. We get involved in the adventures. But the really good ones make us think about our own lives. So at the end of your story, what do you hope your audience carries away from the experience?
Yeah, actually just that. I hope that I've taken concepts, ideas, events that may be perceived in the abstract, or they're large social events. Mm-hmm. And sometimes in our discussion about particularly about race or racial dynamics, it's easy to leave things on that level, on the abstract level. Either we very deeply feel them but don't think about them, don't have a way to bring understanding to those things, or we understand them but don't necessarily feel them. In other words, academicians have done a great deal of work in delving into and explaining racial dynamics through history, but in many cases it remains an academic exercise. But at the same time, of course, race infects every area of our lives, and it is very much our lived experience. So we have strong feelings about it, don't necessarily study it. And that schism seems to be true with stories as well. So what I wanted to do was to take the explanation part and bring it home, to make it personal, to cement it to real events in my life.
Well, thanks very much for coming in. LaRon Williams is going to be appearing at Michigan Theater tomorrow night as part of the University of Michigan's Understanding Race Project. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for inviting me.
And now we're going to head up to Flint. That's where this new theater company is trying to get off the ground. And one of the first new plays that they're performing in Flint is about emergency managers. They've written this original play all about emergency managers. And it might not sound like the easiest topic or the sexiest topic to make a play about, but it has people talking. When I got an email saying this new fledgling theater company in Flint was putting on an original play about emergency managers, I thought to myself, I have got to know who is crazy or masochistic enough to do this.
There's this overwhelming sense of apathy. We have this emergency manager and everyone's like, oh my God, it's like the end of the world. We can't have freedom to do anything. And that is not true.
Well, the answer to my question is Brittany Reed. She's an actress slash Starbucks barista, and she's part of this new company that calls themselves the Shop Floor Theater Company. And being from Flint, they know that lots of people are checked out or disengaged right now because political activism has to take a back seat for those who can barely pay their water bill. So the cast figured, hey, let's get people talking and engaging with issues about democracy and freedom by putting on a show. They are calling it State of Emergency.
Welcome to the dictatorship of Flint.
Welcome to the dictatorship of Flint.
And to give them due credit, they do find the natural drama. They really milk some of the protest scenes. And they base them all on actual events and interviews, like this scene about a local Flint pastor who was actually jailed for protesting against the emergency manager.
We are under a state takeover.
Yeah.
And I can hear the voice of Dr. King declare in these perilous times. Don't you get weary.
No.
We shall overcome someday.
We shall overcome.
But in between those scenes are the other scenes where characters have very detailed discussions about financial solvency and bond ratings and executive orders. And in fact, by the time we hit intermission, I am completely lost, and frankly, half of the audience is asleep.
Well, it was a long play, but I do feel like it was very informational.
This is Deandra Holloway, one of the audience members, and she, like all the rest of the audience members for this preview of the play, is a ninth grader. So really, you can't blame the napping just on the play. It is 3 o'clock on a Friday. These guys have more things on their mind than financial solvency. Still, the play wraps up with some polite applause. And, most importantly, it does get the kids talking. At least the ones who volunteered to stay after with me to talk about the play.
But I don't think we're doing, like, real bad, like other people make it seem.
You think because there's an emergency manager, the rest of the state must be like, oh, they must be a mess.
Yeah.
They quick to just judge us on the bad part, but when we do good, they never acknowledge us.
Lexis McDaniel is another ninth grader, and she says they didn't need a play to know that when your city gets an emergency manager, other people write you off. Her friend Deandra Holloway says that is because those people are outsiders. Outsiders, she says, don't get that Flint feels pride in their community and that they think things can get better here.
I just see that if you do a little work, if we take it day by day, take our time, and I think we can make some progress.
And maybe the conversations like these are really all that the play is trying to do. Whether it's riveting or not, it has people talking about how when it's your city, your home, problems can be bad, but at least they're your problems. Having an emergency manager is like saying not only are things bad, but the people of this city can't even handle them on their own. Brittany Reed, that young actress slash barista, says that is the whole goal of the play.
When there's an announcement like we're getting an emergency manager, I think people just lose hope. It's like, this is happening, but we cannot stop fighting.
State of Emergency is playing in Flint through this Saturday. In Flint, I'm Kate Wells, Michigan Radio News. And finally, our last stop is this small town movie house that is struggling with a big change in technology. Michigan Radio Steve Carmody brings us that report.
The Friday night crowd is gathering in the lobby of the Sun Theater in Williamston. Everyone seems to know everyone else at this small, one-screen neighborhood movie house.
Paige is coming, and Cheryl and Giselle Miller. I'm just the first one. I thought there would be, you know, I thought we would have a hard time getting seats because this is a big movie.
From the low ticket prices to very affordable concessions, the Sun Theater is a throwback, and that's especially true for what's at the top of the stairs at the rear of the theater. A 35mm film is flickering through a projector which shines that night's movie onto the silver screen. It's basically the way films have been shown for 100 years, but that's about to end. For around a decade, movie studios have been transitioning from film to digital projection systems. Instead of multiple reels of film, a digital copy is simply downloaded into a computer at the theater. Now, movie studios plan to stop distributing movies on 35mm film entirely this year. Movie theater chains made the transition to digital projection systems a long time ago, but small local movie theaters like the Sun and Williamston are scrambling to raise the money they need to replace their old film projectors. Mike Doyle fears the digital transition will lead more of Michigan's neighborhood movie theaters to shut their doors. The former Michigan State University professor is an aficionado on Michigan's old movie theaters. He says back in 1947, there were 355 neighborhood movie houses in Michigan. By 2000, that number had dropped to about 70. Mike Doyle says many small neighborhood and drive-in movie theaters may not be able to afford the new digital projection systems, which cost about $80,000 to $100,000.
The expense of converting over to this new system is quite prohibitive for some of these theaters that have no cash flush to even sort of start it out.
The Michigan Economic Development Corporation is looking at options to see what, if anything, can be done to assist local movie theaters with the cost of the transition. But as of now, the theater owners are on their own. For those small theaters making the transition, there may be another problem, the technology itself. Ben Mankiewicz knows something about movies. He's not only a host on cable TV's Turner Classic Movies, his grandfather won an Oscar for the screenplay for Citizen Kane. Mankiewicz says the digital movie experience in many ways replicates the home TV experience, and that's not a good thing.
You're losing that certain kind of sort of texture and depth and look. And really, in many ways, what made film different from television.
Mankiewicz does see a positive side. He says since it costs movie companies less to distribute movies, digital may allow a wider range of movies to be shown in more theaters. Dan Robitaille's family has owned the Sun Theater in Williamston for more than 30 years. He's optimistic about the future of the local movie house. Robitaille says the community has helped raise most of the $80,000 needed to buy and install the theater's new digital projection system. He hopes to have it in place by this summer. Robitaille expects the Sun will remain much the same, with one difference.
The one thing you're not going to see as 35 millimeter goes away is a movie's called a flick, because you see a frame go through, flick, 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 flick. And that's what, you know, why it was always called a flick. And that's going to go away because you're not really going to see that much of the frames going through the light.
And that leads to a question. Can you really still call them films when there really is no actual film involved? I'm Steve Carmody, Michigan Radio News.
Well, that about wraps it up for ArtPod this week. And as always, we want to know what you think about ArtPod and your suggestions and ideas for artists and thinkers that matter in Michigan. So let us know by going to michiganradio.org, and you can click on Share Your Story. From Michigan Radio, I'm Kate Wells. We'll see you next time.
Support for arts and cultural reporting on Michigan Radio comes in part from a grant from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs and the National Endowment for the Arts.